Welcome to Lecture 23, Hearts of Darkness. We left off last time with the discovery of pulsars, very spiky, regularly spaced bursts of radio radiation for which no natural origin could initially be found. Here are the data, not for the first one that was discovered, but for a typical one. Brightness is plotted along the vertical axis, time along the horizontal axis, and you can see that there are these bursts, not all of equal intensity. They vary in intensity, but they're equally spaced, precisely equally spaced. What could be producing this if it's not little green men, okay, which was ruled out? How can you explain the clock-like regularity of pulsars? Well, let's consider several different types of possible stars that could do this. Could a normal star produce bursts of radiation like this by oscillating in size, by growing bigger and smaller? Our sun breathes in this way in a very minute manner. It's just a tiny oscillation in size that occurs. But the period is 5 minutes or so. There are different frequencies, but the typical one is 5 minutes or an hour or whatever. Different stars have different frequencies. None of them are as short as 1 second or a tenth of a second or a hundredth of a second. So that couldn't do it. Even the oscillation in size of a white dwarf is too slow. The characteristic period is 10 seconds for the oscillation of a white dwarf. So that's too slow. What about a neutron star? A neutron star is smaller, denser than a white dwarf, and so it can actually oscillate much more quickly. It's like a high-frequency bell instead of a big, huge, low-frequency bell. Trouble is, a neutron star is too quick. The natural oscillation frequency for a neutron star is about a thousandth of a second. And although a few pulsars are almost that quick, most are of order a tenth of a second or a second, something like that. So a neutron star is simply too fast. So the oscillation of any known type of star doesn't work. How about another mechanism? Orbits. How about if you have two normal stars orbiting each other and somehow once or twice per orbit they let out a beam of radiation? That's much too slow for normal stars. Normal stars cannot orbit each other once per second or 10 times per second because normal stars are too big to even get that close to each other. Okay, they can't get close enough to orbit in such a short period. Well, white dwarfs are a lot smaller. Maybe they can get close enough to each other. The trouble is they're too slow as well. A white dwarf, the size of the Earth, is still too big, basically, to produce that kind of speed. Neutron stars are very small, 10 or 15 kilometers in radius. They could, in principle, orbit each other very closely like this, maybe once per second, 10 times per second, something like that. Okay. The trouble is that they would release gravitational waves by a procedure I'll discuss in a few minutes. They would release orbital energy in the form of these emitted gravitational waves, and the two stars would gradually spiral in towards each other. The period would decrease as they travel towards each other, and we would see a progressively decreasing period for a given pulsar. Instead, pulsar periods are precisely constant, or if anything, slowly increasing. Over many years, you can see that they slowly increase in time, and we can understand that, as I'll show you in a minute. But they certainly do not decrease with time. So energy loss for two orbiting neutron stars basically rules out this hypothesis. Well, all right, if it's not oscillations in size or orbits, what if it's rotation? What if the basic mechanism is rotation? A normal star cannot rotate that quickly. If it were to rotate that quickly, it would fall apart. You try spinning yourself at a couple of times per second, you can feel your hair moving out. Well, if you take a normal star and rotate it very quickly, you know, a normal star is big, it would be flung apart. The so-called centrifugal force would fling it apart. Even a white dwarf basically cannot rotate that quickly. Some of the white dwarfs can rotate maybe down to a half a second period, 1 second, but that would not explain the fast pulsars, those with periods of a tenth of a second or a hundredth of a second. So it was thought that if the white dwarfs can't explain all of them, we should initially look for a different hypothesis that can explain all of them in one blow, so to speak. So white dwarfs don't work. But a neutron star is more compact than a white dwarf. It is able to rotate that quickly without disrupting itself. It's smaller, yet has as much mass, if not more mass, than a white dwarf, and so its gravitational force can keep it bound together. The force of gravity would be greater than this centrifugal force trying to pull it apart, trying to disrupt it. And so there is no known problem with the neutron star hypothesis. There's no obvious problem. And so astronomers quickly settled on rotating neutron stars as the probable origin for pulsars. Moreover, a rotating neutron star would be a very stable object. It would rotate at essentially the same period all of the time. But it is emitting radiation. That's what the pulses are due to. And that emitted radiation has to come from somewhere. It would plausibly come from the energy of rotation of the neutron star. So you would expect the neutron star to gradually spin more and more slowly, for the period to gradually increase, very, very slowly increase. And indeed, that is what is observed for pulsars. Their pulses are nearly constant in period, but over many years you can see that they gradually increase. That would be consistent with a neutron star gradually losing energy. So the basic physical mechanism was converged upon very quickly after the discovery of pulsars. However, the mechanism that produces the actual beam of radiation is not so well understood. We think what's happening is that the neutron star is very highly magnetized. It has a magnetic field resembling that of the Earth, like a bar magnet. So it has a north pole and a south pole. If that magnetic axis is not aligned with the rotation axis, then the magnetic axis will sweep out a cone in the sky. First it'll point in this direction, then somewhat later in another direction, then in another one, and so on. If, in addition, radiation is somehow beamed along that magnetic axis, then we would see that radiation, if our eye is over here in this direction somewhere, we would see it once per rotation period as that beam intersects our line of sight. It's just like a lighthouse. It's on all the time, but you only see it when it happens to be pointing your way, right? You only see it when it's pointing your way. So there it's off, and then it's on again for you and you and you and you and you and so on, okay? So you would see it once per rotation, or if the axis of the magnetic field is precisely perpendicular to the rotation axis, then you would see first one beam and then the other. So you would see it twice per rotation. But either once or twice per rotation, you would see this pulse of light. So the beam would be on all the time, but you would only see it when it's pointing at you. So that's the idea here. The trouble is, how do you actually produce this beam of radiation? It's not entirely understood, but if you have a very strong magnetic field that is rotating, Maxwell's, James Clerk Maxwell's equations, which we studied way back in lecture number 3, they tell us that an electric field is generated by a rotating magnetic field. And that electric field can accelerate charged particles along the poles or along the axis of the field. And accelerated charged particles produce electromagnetic radiation. The details of how you get so much electromagnetic radiation are not understood very well now. But the basic idea is thought to be this lighthouse model. Okay? So that's the idea behind pulsars. Very good evidence that explosions of massive stars leave behind a neutron star, which in some cases can be pulsating, comes from the Crab Nebula. This is the expanding ejecta, the debris seen from a star that exploded in the year 1054. Asian astronomers watched it. Supposedly it first appeared on July 4th, although I don't think July 4th has any special significance for the Asian culture as it does here. Anyway, it was seen for quite some time, a year or two afterwards. You could still see this glowing star. It was visible during the day. And at the location of that explosion, we now see this nebula, all right, expanding debris. And in the middle of that nebula, what you find is a pulsar. Here is a picture when it's not pointing at us. You can't see it. And here is a picture when it is pointing at us. So it's blinking at us. And this one blinks 33 times per second. So it has a period of only 33rd of a second. It's a very young pulsar. It's not even 1,000 years old. And indeed, if pulsars slow down gradually with time, we would expect the youngest ones to be rotating most rapidly. Most pulsars are more like 100,000 years old, up to 1,000,000 years old, and so they've slowed down a little bit. Plus, this one might be an exceptionally rapid rotator to begin with. We're not sure. But in any case, there it is, a pulsar in the middle of the Crab Nebula, which we know to be the remnant from an exploding star. So the evidence is pretty good. It's unlikely that this is a chance superposition, especially since we now know that the nebula glows due to the radiation coming from this pulsar, this rotating neutron star. The neutron star, in the case of the Crab Nebula, is seen not just at optical and radio wavelengths, but also at X-ray wavelengths. This is an X-ray telescope image when it's pointing toward us and when it's pointing not toward us. Most pulsars are seen only at radio wavelengths. Only the young, energetic ones are seen at optical and X-ray wavelengths as well. Well, there's a number of ways in which a neutron star can not be a pulsar, not be an observed pulsar. Suppose you've got this magnetic axis here, but you're viewing the whole thing from this direction over here. Your eye is over there. You will never see the beam pointing at you because you're simply in the wrong direction. It's as though you're above the lighthouse, for example. If you're above the lighthouse, you'll never see the beam. So some neutron stars may well be pulsars, but would not be recognized as such. Moreover, as the neutron star ages, its magnetic field may decrease in intensity. Moreover, the rotation rate definitely slows down. Both effects decrease the strength of the generated electric field. And at some point, the electric field might become too weak to generate this beam of charged particles that supposedly produces the radiation. So for a number of reasons, not all neutron stars will be observable as pulsars. They might be off, or they might be pointed the wrong way. But we do believe that every pulsar is a neutron star. So every pulsar is a neutron star, but not every neutron star will be visible as a pulsar. A few neutron stars are visible not as pulsars. Here's a neutron star, a very dim one, imaged with the Hubble Space Telescope. It is not a pulsar. It's a young neutron star that is still hot enough to be glowing at optical wavelengths, and we see it. But that is one of the few cases in which we directly see a neutron star. Usually we only see the indirect aspects of it, the beam pointing toward us. So neutron stars and pulsars are a great thing. The pulsar discovery was one of the most magnificent in all time. It showed that these bizarre forms of matter were a whole mass of the sun is compressed into something the size of the city. Those exist. And Jocelyn Bell is the one who found them. She deserved a Nobel Prize for her work. Her advisor did receive the Nobel Prize in part for this work, and I feel, as do most other scientists, that Jocelyn should have shared in the credit, but for whatever reason she did not. It's too bad. Well, this brings us now to the general theory of relativity, Einstein's fantastic idea that what gravity really is a curvature of space-time. Space-time is the three spatial dimensions we know of plus time. What Einstein said is that gravity is a curvature, a warping of space-time. Neither one is flat and linear like a sheet of paper. It might be far away from a mass, but a mass causes a warping in that structure. And particles and light follow their natural paths through this curved space. And that is what causes the phenomenon that we call gravitation. See, Newton, when he determined his law, F equals gmm over d squared, he had no mechanism for producing the force. He just said this is quantitatively what it is. And since that time, physicists have been trying to find a mechanism. What is it that produces the force? Einstein's theory says that what produces the force is a warping of space. And I would like to talk about that in this lecture and show you how neutron stars provide one of the best tests of this general theory of relativity, a theory that gravity is actually geometry. It's a different geometry around massive objects. Here's what the general relativity theory is trying to say. Let's suppress the time dimension but only look at the spatial dimensions. And let's suppress one of those. So you can go that way and back, and you can go in the perpendicular direction. This is an oblique view, so it doesn't look perpendicular, but it is. And away from massive objects, it looks like just a normal rectangle. Space-time is flat. It looks like a sheet of paper, at least in these two dimensions. But if you have an object like the sun down at the bottom here, what the sun does is it produces a dimple in this otherwise flat space. And it's the motion of particles in the vicinity of the dimple that changes their paths. Okay? I'll illustrate that in a minute. Here is sort of an artist's view of what this might look like. A rubber sheet stretched across a table tightly will produce sort of a flat surface, and an ant crawling along that surface would walk in a straight line as we have generally defined straight lines, lines that don't curve. Okay. Well, all right. Lines that don't curve are straight in flat space like this, but we will see that lines in an intrinsically curved space are themselves curved. And that's because they represent the shortest distance between two points. But the shortest distance between two points on a curved surface is itself what looks in projection like a curved line. For example, pilots going from one city to another, way on the other side of the Earth, tend to follow paths called great circles. Those are the shortest distances between two points. They have to take into account jet streams and all that, but if there were no jet streams, they would follow perfect great circles. And those projected onto a plane look like a curved path, but they are the shortest distance between two points on a curved surface. So if we were to place a paperweight on this rubber sheet, it would curve the sheet, and the path of the ant along the sheet would appear curved to us. It couldn't go across the hole because that's not a spatial dimension into which it can go. It's constricted to remain on the sheet itself, and so its path appears curved. Let me show you that with a demo. I have here a drum head around which a rubber sheet is stretched, like this. So I can roll a ball bearing along this flat surface, and it goes in a straight line. There's no warping of this surface. It's completely flat. All right? Now let me put a bigger ball bearing in the middle of it here. That causes a dimple in this rubber sheet. And if I now roll the little one, you can see that it follows a curved path. Let me do it again. Like that, you see? Here's another one. Look at that. And in fact, the ball bearing gets attracted to this big one. And it's because of the dimple that the small ball bearing got attracted to the big one. All right, so that's the idea behind the curvature of space. When Einstein proposed his theory in 1916, there was known to be an interesting aspect of the planet Mercury's orbit around the sun. Mercury, as shown here, goes around the sun not in a completely closed orbit, but rather one that sort of bends around itself. It goes along like this, whips around, it's a fairly elliptical orbit, then comes around like this, like that. And you can see that it rotates around, it precesses is the word. And that phenomenon was not understood until Einstein's theory of relativity. The precession is very small. The angle that this ellipse sweeps out over time is only 43 arc seconds per century. So it only shifts by 43 seconds of arc per century. That's a very small shift. That's because the sun's gravitational field is quite weak compared to what general relativity deals with. The effects of general relativity differ from Newton's law, you know, only when the fields are very large. When the fields are small, the deviations are very small. So this deviation was small, and people weren't even sure whether it might be produced by some other effect. Maybe the sun's shape is oblate. That would change Newton's prediction for what Mercury's orbit should do. So other tests were needed to see whether general relativity is correct. The second of the classical tests I've already mentioned before when we discussed the eclipses of the sun, that was the effect that the sun when blotted out, makes the sky dark enough, or allows the sky to be dark enough that we can see stars. And their apparent positions in the sky were farther out from the limb or edge of the sun than their true positions. The true positions were measured in a photograph taken 6 months earlier when the sun wasn't in that part of the sky. And then 6 months later, when it was in the sky but eclipsed, Arthur Eddington in 1919 took another photograph, and he measured the apparent positions compared with the true positions and found a tiny, tiny shift, roughly 1.7 arc seconds for a star that's close to the limb of the sun. The effect becomes smaller the farther away a star is from the limb. That made Einstein an overnight celebrity, but again, this is a fairly weak field test. There could be competing forms or laws for gravity, theories of gravity, that would predict largely the same effect. Yet Einstein's was the only theory at that time that had been given as an alternate for Newton's theory. Still, since that time, other people have thought up other theories that might have given that large an effect. And then the third test was that a photon coming out from a gravitational field or from an object with a mass gets gradually redshifted as it leaves this thing. So here's the photon, and it's blue initially, and I'm greatly exaggerating the effect here, but as it gets out of the gravitational field, that is, goes to weaker and weaker fields, it gradually loses energy and becomes more red. A blue photon, when it loses energy, becomes redder. And this is a very slight effect in weak gravitational fields. Again, it was measured. It wasn't measured until 1960s in this case. Some people measured the gradual decrease in the energy of a photon as it went from the bottom of a building, the ground floor, to the top floor. It's a very precise sort of, it's a very difficult effect to measure. You have to have very precise apparatus with which to measure it. But it was seen. But again, you know, these are all weak field approximations to gravity. The Earth has an even weaker field than the Sun, and one could conceive of alternates to the general theory of relativity. So what we would like is a strong field test of the predictions of general relativity, where its predictions might deviate from the predictions of competing models. That is provided by neutron stars. And in particular, the best existing evidence for the correctness of Einstein's theory of gravity, as opposed to other people's, comes from an object known as the binary pulsar. This is actually two neutron stars in close orbit around one another. Here they are, M1 and M2. They both have about 1.4 solar masses of mass. Indeed, all measured neutron stars have 1.4 solar masses within a few tenths of a solar mass, in agreement with the expectation that these things are produced by the collapse of a 1.4 solar mass core in a massive star. These things are orbiting each other so closely that their period is only 8 hours. They're really whizzing around each other. They're sort of very close to each other, going zoom, 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 like this. And you can think of their gravitational pits, the distortions they produce in space-time, as essentially overlapping each other. Here you see the two pits overlapping each other. Now, as they whiz around each other, these distortions, say, in the rubber sheet, produce a ripple that moves away from the binary. It's as though you took two fingers in a pond, for example, pierced the surface of the pond, and then rotated your fingers around like this. You would send a ripple through the pond. These ripples are called gravity waves. They are a prediction of Einstein's theory. They are a loss of energy from the system. The loss of energy has to be compensated by a decrease in the orbital energy of the two stars. And so they actually come closer together. They spiral in towards each other because they're losing the kinetic energy of their orbit. And that allows gravity to pull them closer together. And they then start circling faster. It's kind of like Mercury circles the sun faster than the Earth does because it's closer to the sun. So they whiz around each other more and more quickly. And this decrease of the orbital period due to the emission of gravity waves has been measured because one of those two neutron stars is a pulsar. And from the changing Doppler shift, We can tell the orbit of that pulsar around the normal non-pulsar neutron star, and we can see that that orbital period is decreasing. And it is decreasing at precisely the rate predicted by general relativity. Precisely. And it does not agree with the rates predicted by competing theories. This is quite a strong field test of general relativity. Moreover, the orbit of one star around the other is not perfectly circular. It's elliptical, like that of Mercury around the Sun. And it precesses around just as Mercury does. But instead of having a precession angular rate of only 43 arc seconds per century, this system is predicted to precess at 4 degrees per year. That's a lot bigger than 43 arc seconds per century. That, too, can be noticed from the arrival time of the pulses. The pulsar is a perfect clock, and by looking at slight deviations of the expected arrival time from the observed arrival time, you can then compare those deviations with the predictions of these theories and see whether they're correct. And again, general relativity passes with flying colors. The Nobel Prize was awarded for this work to Joe Taylor and Russell Hulse of Princeton University a few years ago. Again, a very well-deserved Nobel Prize, but in this case, Russell Hulse, who was a graduate student at the time that he discovered the binary pulsar, he correctly did share in the Nobel Prize, whereas Jocelyn Bell did not. This neutron degeneracy pressure cannot support a neutron star with a mass greater than about 2 or 3 solar masses. Okay? It'll collapse after that. It'll collapse into an even denser object, an object which might provide an even better test of the general theory of relativity. Because what you want to test the general theory of relativity is the strongest gravitational field possible. You want the deviations of Einstein's theory of gravity to be as large as possible from the predictions of Newton's form of gravity or for competing hypotheses in order to be able to distinguish which one is correct. So suppose you have matter which is compressed into a really small volume, but it has more than 2 or 3 times the sun's mass. Then the physics of this degenerate neutron matter suggests that it will not be able to hold itself up. It becomes unstable. But unlike a white dwarf, whose instability is manifested in the explosion of the white dwarf as a type 1 supernova, in the case of a neutron star, there's nothing to explode. It's just a bunch of neutrons already. You can't have fusion reactions. So it responds by collapsing to an even smaller volume. And this might occur, for example, if you have 2 or 3 neutron stars of 1.4 solar masses each merging together. If they merge together at the end of this process of the binary pulsar, you know, those two guys are spiraling into each other, so they will eventually merge. They will have a mass that exceeds 2, maybe not 3 solar masses, but depending on what this limit exactly is, and we don't know what it is because we don't know neutron star properties very well, it might collapse still further. Or an unsuccessful supernova whose core is collapsing, it might not successfully eject the outer material. Suppose it ejects it part way, and then the stuff comes back down, as in the case of the ball bouncing off of my tennis ball. Earth's gravity brought it back. That was not a successful explosion. So in the case of this core collapse, you might, again, have a lot of material collapsing down to a small volume. And some stars in the 20 to 100 solar mass range might fail to explode by the mechanism I described in the last two lectures and might instead continue to collapse. Well, that's what you would get. There's my prize-winning photograph of a black hole. You would get a region whose local gravitational field is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape. And if you'd like to pay me $10,000 for this photograph, I'll be glad to take your money. You can take a photograph of like this yourself by just leaving the lens cap on your camera. Okay, it's easy to do. Don't need advanced equipment. But that's what a black hole would look like if you were viewing it and if there were nothing in orbit around it or no glowing gas or anything like that. That is a black hole. It's black. Nothing gets out. It's a fantastic object whose gravity is strong enough to hold everything in. And in Newton's theory, That's not really predicted because, first of all, light isn't affected by the gravitational force in Newton's theory. Light has no mass, and Newton's law is that F equals GMM over D squared. So if one of the M's is zero, it shouldn't be affected. But in relativity, light is affected. Okay? It's affected because relativity says that there is no such thing as a gravitational force per se. It's a curvature of space-time. And a black hole is such a deep pit that not even light can get out. Light curves around itself within a black hole and cannot get out. So there's no real force. It's just that the geometry of space is different around this object. Sufficiently curved, and the well is sufficiently steep-sided that light can't pummel its way out. It remains trapped inside. We can consider this heuristically by looking at Newton's law, just to get some idea of how this might occur even in Newton's version. The force is attractive, it's negative, GMM over D squared. Suppose I have an object on the surface of the Earth. We know that I can throw it, in principle, if I were Hercules, with a speed that, neglecting air resistance, would allow that object to escape. If I throw an object normally, I can't throw it fast enough to get it to escape. But if I throw it sufficiently fast with the escape velocity, it'll go away from the Earth forever. It'll slow down as it does so, but it'll go away forever. Suppose now I keep the mass of the Earth the same, but I compress it to half its radius and keep the ball at the new surface of the Earth, not its old distance, but now half the distance from the center. Well, if the distance of the center to the center went down by a factor of 2, the inverse square of 1/2 is 4. So the force on that ball increases by a factor of 4. That means that I would have to throw the ball faster to get it to escape from Earth. The escape velocity would increase. Now let's suppose I keep the Earth's mass the same and I squish it down even more. Well, now the two masses remain the same, but the distance between their centers has decreased. So if this denominator decreases, then the force increases in magnitude, and the escape velocity would become even higher. Consider this process to its logical conclusion. Forgetting about light and photons, just think about balls. If I continue this process to its logical conclusion, I come to a size for the Earth which is so small that the local gravitational field is sufficiently strong to make the escape velocity equal to the velocity of light. So I would not be able to throw a ball and get it to escape because the speed of escape would be the speed of light or greater, and I cannot throw any material object at or exceeding the speed of light, according to Einstein's special theory of relativity. So that then would be an object from which no material particle can escape. That much even Newton's law tells us. What relativity tells us is how this works formally, correctly. You know, it turns out you can't even use Newton's laws for such compressed masses. But relativity tells us that you get qualitatively this conclusion, and quantitatively it tells you to what radius you have to compress the sphere to get the speed to equal or exceed the escape velocity. Moreover, relativity tells us that even light is affected. What is that size? Well, for a given mass m, a black hole forms if the radius of the object that's being compressed becomes smaller than or equal to 2 times Newton's gravitational constant times the mass of the gravitating object divided by the speed of light squared. That is called the Schwarzschild radius, R sub s, after Karl Schwarzschild, who formally derived it shortly after Einstein's publication of the theory of relativity. You have to compress things to a very small size for them to become a black hole. You would have to compress the sun to a radius of 3 kilometers or less to get it to form a black hole. Now, the sun's true radius right now is 700,000 kilometers. So you'd have to compress it one heck of a lot to make it form a black hole. The Earth would have to be compressed to something like 0.9 centimeters in radius for it to become a black hole. There is no vice in the universe that we know of that can do this, that can compress the sun or the earth into something that small. But I will show you mechanisms in a few minutes that might be able to compress things into such a small object. The spherical surface, having a radius equal to the Schwarzschild radius, is called the event horizon of the black hole. A horizon because you can't see beyond it. From outside a black hole, we cannot detect any signals originating from objects within the black hole. Why not? Because no light can escape. And if light can't escape, carrier pigeons can't escape, and FedEx can't escape. Nothing can escape. You cannot get any information beyond the horizon of a black hole. Why is it called an event? Well, probably because it's a real event. If you go past this point, right, this surface, you'll never get out to tell your friends about the experience. So you are forever lost from the outside world. That is an event, and so it's called an event horizon, all right? Abandon hope, all ye who enter here, okay? Dante's Inferno, what they were really thinking about was black holes, all right? That's what they really were thinking about. All right, well, there's an interesting theorem in black hole physics that a black hole has no hair. That sounds silly. What do physicists mean by a black hole having no hair? What they mean is that, in essence, a black hole is actually a very simple object. The only thing that you can tell about a black hole from the outside, observing it, measuring it, is its mass, its electric charge, and its spin, its angular momentum. It can be spinning. Those are the only three properties. You cannot tell what the black hole is made of. You cannot tell whether you threw dinosaurs into it or Bibles or anything else. You don't know what's in it. You don't know whether it was a star, a planet, a galaxy. You just know that it has a certain mass, a certain charge, which is normally zero, because if it were charged, it would quickly attract the opposite charges toward it, and it would become electrically neutral. So we don't expect to see charged black holes in nature. But in principle, if you had one, you would be able to detect its charge. And you can detect the spin. And we do expect spinning black holes to be present in nature because collapsed stars are spinning, and their collapsed cores would be spinning as well. So we do expect black holes to be rotating. There are no other details. There's no hair sticking out. When the black hole is first forming, there are gravitational disturbances that you can measure. But once it has reached equilibrium, there is no hair. It's a very simple object. So that's the no-hair theorem of a black hole. There's a number of myths surrounding black holes. One of the most popular is that black holes are gargantuan objects that are like cosmic vacuum cleaners, sucking up everything for vast distances surrounding them. They just go around, just like some giant sea monster sucking things in from far, far away. And if there's even a single black hole in our galaxy, we should fear it because we are going to be inexorably drawn in. False. Black holes have a strong influence on their surroundings, only very close to them. Far away, you can easily achieve a nice stable orbit around a black hole. Far away, there's no real problem. And if, for example, there were some cosmic vice that could compress the sun to form a black hole, Earth's orbit would be completely unaffected. Admittedly, it would be cold and dark here because there'd be no sunlight, but the orbit of the Earth around the sun would be completely unaffected. Why? Well, because we're far from the sun. And Newton's law, GMM over D squared, describes our motion quite adequately, just perfectly fine, in fact. The M's don't change, the D doesn't change, so the force hasn't changed. Only close to the sun, and in particular, only at distances below what would have been the radius, the former radius of the sun, would you get a stronger gravitational field, and you'd have to watch out. Now, you'd have to watch out when you're getting pretty close to the sun, just so that you have to aim your rockets in the right direction. You don't want to aim toward the black hole. But only very close to the black hole is it extremely difficult to aim the right way and get yourself out of there. The other myth is that black holes can form just anywhere for no apparent reason. They just form. Like, you see lots of cartoons where someone's standing there in the room and suddenly a black hole forms and everything is sucked in. Black holes are actually hard to form. I mentioned that our sun will not ever form a black hole. It'll form a white dwarf. We know of four methods that might produce black holes. One is the merging of neutron stars or other objects, where the final mass of the merged object exceeds two or three solar masses. All right? So neutron degeneracy pressure is not able to hold it up. That's one way. Another way is if a very massive star fails to undergo a successful supernova. That can cause it to collapse and form a black hole because it's its own vice. It's a big, huge 10 solar mass object whose gravity pulls it in. That's a big vice. All right. Another way you can do it is in the centers of galaxies where there's so much material that it sort of gravitates together to form a giant supermassive object in the middle, and that can form a black hole. And later on, I'll show you quite good evidence that we have that the centers of many galaxies have black holes 100 million to a billion times the mass of our sun. So there's three mechanisms. The fourth is more speculative. Hawking and some of his colleagues believe that early in the history of the universe, shortly after the Big Bang, when the density of the universe was high, there could have been fluctuations in the density, the high density fluctuations having the ability to collapse to form little tiny microscopic black holes. They're called mini black holes. We don't know that they exist, but that is a mechanism that could, in principle, work. So those are the only four ways we know of. We don't know of any other vices that can produce black holes out of, say, a ball like this. So they're hard to form, and they're not all over the place. What would you see if you looked at, say, the supernova 1987A remnant? If there were a neutron star there, as we believe there is, I would actually expect to see a pulsar, or at least the radiation coming from the pulsar heating the material around it. We see no extra glow associated with the central region of supernova 87A right now that we can unambiguously attribute to radiation from a pulsar or from a rotating neutron star or from even an accreting neutron star. If there was a neutron star there, you might expect it to be getting material from the outside and releasing some energy. I think there could well be a black hole in the center of supernova 87A now. Maybe the neutron star, well, we know the neutron star formed at least temporarily because the neutrinos were seen, but maybe shortly after the neutron star was formed, it accreted enough material that it then passed above its instability limit and collapsed further to become a black hole. I should say that not all astronomers believe this. Many of us think that there's maybe a 50-50 or a 30-70 chance that there's a black hole in the center of supernova 87A right now. There are ways around the argument that I just told you. But in the next few years, we might get better and better evidence that what remains there is not a neutron star, but rather a black hole. We're just not sure right now. Now, let's consider what one would see on the surface or from the surface of a star that is collapsing to become a black hole. Initially, when it's very big, you see hardly any of these gravitational effects. A photon aimed up will lose some of its energy and become redshifted. It'll go from yellow to red, but not by much because the star is big and the local gravitational field is small. Similarly, if you aim a photon at an angle relative to the vertical, it'll bend a little bit due to the star's gravitational field, but not much. As you compress the star, these effects will become more pronounced. The gravitational redshifting will become bigger, and the bending of the light will become bigger as well. As you compress the star still more, you start getting really weird effects. When the star's surface is 1.5 times the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole that it will become, then the gravitational redshifting effect is quite severe. Light goes from, you know, yellow to red. Moreover, light aimed at an angle is bent so much that you can actually send it in orbit around the star. And you could actually see the back of your head. If you shined a flashlight on the back of your head, and if it's shiny, all right, it would reflect light, send that light around, and that light would reach your eyes. So you could see the back of your head at this position of the so-called photon sphere. Well, as you compress the star even more, the redshifting effect becomes still more pronounced. Photons lose a lot of energy on their way out, and the bending effect gets very pronounced, such that if you send the light at some angle, it won't even escape. It'll bend back around and enter this thing, which is not yet a black hole, but almost. So that light ray would enter, that light ray would nearly enter, not quite. This light ray would escape. The light rays aimed close to the vertical would escape, but those aimed at an angle might not escape. And then, finally, when the radius of the star reaches the Schwarzschild radius and an event horizon forms, then the exit cone, the cone into which you can shine a flashlight beam and have it escape, that exit cone shrinks to zero. No light can escape, and the object becomes a black hole. What's inside? Well, the star continues to collapse mathematically to a singular point of zero size and infinite density. We think probably it stops short of being zero size. Quantum physics makes it have a small but finite size, non-zero. But it'll still be very, very dense, and you wouldn't want to be there. In the next lecture, I'll discuss some of the amazing aspects of black holes, and we'll see evidence that these bizarre creatures of mathematical physics really do exist.